Good afternoon. I'm Rose Mage, and on behalf of the Immunology Interest Group and the NIH Walls Lecture Series, I'd like to welcome you today. It's really a great pleasure to welcome our speaker, Dr. Max Cooper, who will be presenting today's Walls Lecture. Max is Director of the Division of Developmental and Clinical Immunology and Professor of Medicine, Pediatrics, Microbiology, and Pathology at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, Alabama, where he has been on the faculty since 1967. After obtaining his MD from Tulane in 1957, he earned board certification in pediatrics in 1962 and joined the renowned group of Dr. Robert Good in 1963. A classic paper in Nature 2 years later, simply entitled Delineation of Thymic and Bursal Lymphoid Systems in the Chicken, set the stage for our current understanding of the roles of T and B, which stands for bursal, lymphocytes, in the immune system. Their search for the mammalian equivalent of the avian bursa of Fabricius led them to suggest that rabbit gut-associated lymphoid tissue, or GALT, was necessary for development of humoral immunity. And we now understand that specialized sites developing in the GALT of several mammalian species are true homologs of the chicken bursa, and the rabbit appendix and chicken bursa maintain an important shared function in generating the diversification of the B-cell repertoire by gene conversion of rearranged antibody heavy and light chain genes. Max has gone on to contribute to important clinical and basic advances in our understanding of developmental immunobiology, particularly of B and T cell differentiation, and clinical immunology, with emphasis on immunodeficiency diseases and lymphoid malignancies. He is an investigator of the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, a member of the National Academy of Sciences. He is on numerous advisory committees, recipient of numerous awards, and author of more than 600 papers and chapters. I first met Max at a meeting in about 1967 organized by Dr. Good on ontogeny of immunity, and I learned at that time that the Good Lab was also pursuing the phylogeny of the immune system. And at that time, they were searching for the origins of the immune system in lower animals, including jawless vertebrates. It's therefore particularly exciting that Max will now be describing some surprising answers to the question that was raised and joked about a lot back in the early 60s, can you find it in hagfish? His lecture today is entitled Evolution of the Two Adaptive Immune Systems, and I'd like to welcome Max.
Thank you very much, Rose, for your kind and gracious introduction. It's nice to be back here with you again. We came for many times to do experiments together back many years ago on ontogeny of B lineage differentiation in rabbits. At that time, we were focusing on hematopoietic tissue, mainly the fetal liver, which indeed generates pre-B cells and B cells as well, the diversification being especially important in those GALT tissues, as you've and others have shown. It's nice to be back on campus to see a lot of old friends, although this is the first time I've been here since you've been fenced in. But it's a delight to be here. As Rose mentioned, I'm going to be talking about evolution of adaptive immune systems today. As you all know, she's told you how old I am, but we're going to be reaching back even to more ancient times than that. Remember that life started on our planet more than 3.5 billion years ago, the data would suggest. And single-cell organisms ruled our planet until about 600 million years ago. And at that time, multicellular organisms began to develop, at a time that atmospheric oxygen levels increased rather dramatically. And those multicellular organisms, or protozoans, began to form, perhaps one of the oldest types, as suggested in this review, might have looked something like this sponge-like organism. But all of a sudden, many different metazoan lineages were generated, and all of them have very complex innate immune systems to allow them to deal with microbes and other competitors and cooperators in their microenvironment, presumably. But only in our lineage, the vertebrates, has anyone found a recombinatorial adaptive immune system based on clonally distributed lymphocytes with clonally diverse antigen receptors. And I'm going to tell you about another kind of adaptive immune system that was evolved in jawless vertebrates that uses different building blocks than the ones that our T-cell receptor and B-cell receptors utilize, with putting together different combinations of immunoglobulin gene segments. First, I'm going to tell you a little bit about, or review quickly, how we happen to recognize this second type of adaptive immune system, tell you something about how the diversity is generated, a little bit about the antigen receptors that are encoded after this recombinatorial assembly process, and then bring you up to date on some of the things that we've learned about how the jawless vertebrates can use this clonally diverse set of receptors to accomplish an immune response. Now, all of you know that we jawed vertebrates all the way back to cartilaginous fish, sharks, skates, and rays, have basically the same kind of immune system. Gary Littman and Martin Flanick and other evolutionary immunologists have shown us that they have, even the sharks and other cartilaginous fish, have the same kinds of T-cell receptor genes that we have, alpha, beta, gamma, delta. They also have multiple heavy chain loci and multiple light chain loci encoding B-cell receptor building blocks. They are organized a little bit differently, the immunoglobulin gene segments. Instead of being distributed, the VD and Js, in families, they are in clusters together with the constant region genes. And so they differ in that way. But no one had been able to find the roots of our adaptive immune system, as Rose indicated. None of the cardinal elements of the adaptive immune system, the T-cell receptor genes, antibody genes, MHC class 1 and 2, and the recombinase activating genes, when we began this search. Another question that was asked when we started dividing our lymphocyte world into compartmentalized T and B cell differentiation was, which came first? And that's been a question that's haunted many people. And as we've learned about the genes that encode for these antigen receptors, that question has been refined, but it's still been highly debated. So one of the reasons that we wanted to go back and look at earlier vertebrates was to try and find the roots of our adaptive immune system. Now, there were clues that jawless vertebrates could achieve adaptive responses following immunization. Best or most data was in lamprey, one of the two living jawless vertebrates, but hagfish had similar data. They were said to be able to reject skin allografts faster with the second set allografts, and even something that looked like delayed type hypersensitivity after immunization with BCG, the human tuberculosis vaccine, and testing with old tuberculin. More impressive, because these phenomena, allograft rejection can be seen even in invertebrates. But Lamprey was said to be able to make circulating agglutinins with antigen specificity, or at least crude antigen specificity, and in higher titers after booster immunization. Most of this data had been regarded as not meaningful because the antibody and T cell receptor genes and their MHC genes hadn't been found. Nevertheless, they were thought to have lymphocyte-like cells that achieved these responses, and these were relatively steroid-sensitive compared to other blood cell types. And what really drew our attention was a report by Jan Klein and his colleagues at the Max Planck Institute in Tübingen of a SPI-B transcription factor homolog in lamprey. And SPI-B is, of course, a member of the PU.1 family, and this one is thought to be particularly important in B lymphopoiesis in mammalian species. So we set out, Jan Klein's and my lab, to go back and re-examine the question of what lamprey were using for these responses. And I show you here a quick resume of the lamprey's life history, knowing that probably few of you are working with the lamprey or maybe even eating them these days. They grow to be about a foot and a half long, the sea lampreys that we work with. And when they migrated into the landlocked Great Lakes of North America, when canals were dug to allow sea creatures to get into these Great Lakes, they wiped out the native fish population of all the Great Lakes. And they are a nuisance, so they're being toxins are being used to try and disrupt their life cycle. The adult are said to be able to, they have a round mouth. They don't have jaws, of course. That mouth is ringed by very sharp teeth. And they have a very strong suction capability. In fact, their name, Petromyzoan, means rock sucker. And they use that mouth to latch on to the side of a fish. The tongue has a tooth-like projection and is a rasp-like function. They erode the skin and they suck the blood and tissues and kill fish in that way. After about a year or a year and a half, though, they go back into the streams where they were born that drain into these, in this case, the Great Lakes of North America, and the male builds a little shelter by picking up pebbles to shelter against the stream. The male and the female mate. The female lays lots of eggs that are fertilized by the male. And of these hundreds of eggs, many of them hatch, and the larvae live in this mud or sandy loam kind of soil for very long periods of time, up to even 15 years of life, before they undergo metamorphosis, where they get larger, retract the hoods from their eyes, and their teeth get bigger. We work with these larvae because they are vegetarians. They are easy to keep in a simple aquarium with sand in the bottom, and we feed them brewer's yeast every couple of weeks. The disadvantage is that they're relatively small. The large ones are about as big as this pencil. they get to be around 10, 11, or 12 centimeters. So our plan, Jan's and mine, was to go in and try and use flow cytometry to focus on lymphocyte-like cells using like scatter characteristics, isolate them to create cDNA libraries to and have those sequenced to explore their transcriptome, hoping in that way to find out what they were using for these adaptive immune responses. We obtained cells. It turned out there are not very many tissues that you can get many cells from. We used this spleen-like hematopoietic tissue. The intestine folds around it, and it runs the length of the intestine. So it's easy to pull out this. And also, there are lots of lymphocyte-like cells in the ventral aspects of the kidney. And I'll show you another site as well. So in looking at these cells by forward and side light scatter, you can see this little button of cells with the light scatter characteristics of lymphocytes. This is how an intraepithelial lymphocyte subpopulation would look if you got it from a human or a mouse or a chicken or a fish. And they look like lymphocytes, even by transmission EM. But that's a very nondescript cell, of course. They're a little bit smaller than our lymphocytes, but otherwise undistinguishable. In among the first 8,000 cDNA sequences that we obtained and annotated, we found lots of genes that our lymphocytes use. Transcription factors, many of the highly conserved signaling cascade elements. We even found Artemis, which cuts the hairpin loops that are created at the coding joints during VDJ rearrangement. And we found some of these same elements that hematopoietic and lymphoid cells express. We found some of the adaptor factors that B cell and T cell receptors use in their responses, some of the Sark family members, SICK. We found a herpes virus entry molecule, the CXCR4 homolog, that's well known now, of course, as the co-receptor for HIV-1. Interestingly, we didn't find any of the interferons or any interferon receptors, and I don't think any other organisms that are this basal on the phylogenetic trees have been found to express them either. We found other factors. So just to quickly sum up, we found several components that are involved, for instance, in B-cell signaling, SICK, phospholipase C-gamma-2, BCAP, which is a favorite topic of Tomo Kiritani, who lent me his slide. But we didn't find any of the genes encoding T or B cell receptors or MHC, class 1 and class 2. So we went back and we made other cDNA libraries. By this time, Zev Panzer, a talented molecular biologist, had joined my laboratory as a postdoctoral fellow, and we got a total of over 17,000 cDNA sequences. And among them, these are just concentrated for those that might be expected to be expressed on the surface of cells. Zev found a T-cell receptor-like and a CD4-like sequence. And we were pretty excited about this. And the most membrane distal of the Yig domains of the T-cell receptor-like sequence had both V and J-like sequences in that domain. And when we threaded that sequence onto mouse TCRB alpha, one that whose structure had been solved, and use this position-specific sequence matrix 3D modeling to see if it was a look-alike. It came up with a very strong resemblance to the mouse TCRV alpha in this case. Even though it only had 25% amino acid identity, which is in the twilight zone, of course. This value was obtained even with one gap only, and that gap would have been where the VDJ junction would have been for this mouse T-cell receptor V-alpha. So that would be expected. Although slightly higher identity of the IG domain that we compared for CD4 with human CD4, the fit was not nearly so good. But both of these were expressed in lymphocytes and in tissues that had lots of lymphocytes in them, but not in other types of blood cells or tissues that wouldn't have many lymphocyte-like cells in them. So it seemed to be expressed in the right place and on lymphocyte-like cells in the lamprey, two of these molecules. However, when we went to the genome, there was only one gene, TCR-like gene, in the genome that we could find, and the V domain or V-like domain with V and J-like sequences was encoded by a single exon. So this obviously couldn't provide the basis for a diverse set of antigen recognition receptors. So we were again back to this point where we didn't have any of the cardinal elements of the adaptive immune system that we were looking for. Now, there wasn't a lot of other opening for other species to go back and look to. Of the jawless vertebrates, as I mentioned, only two are still living. All of these other jawless vertebrates that are on this diagram by Janvier died out, it's thought, somewhere around 400 million years ago. And all we know about them is from their fossil remains. There's no DNA available for us to explore them. The hagfish is, if anything, more basal, it's thought, by its anatomical structure and its physical appearance. And it also has fewer of these lymphocyte-like cells that we were interested in exploring. So we decided that perhaps a better approach would be to catch these lamprey and their cells in the act of achieving these adaptive responses that had been reported. So we injected the lamprey larvae with a cocktail of live bacteria. We used E. coli, sheep erythrocytes, and two plant mitogens, PHA and oakweed mitogen, that will trigger our TNB cells. And after several injections of these, we bled them, and as you can see by this, again, forward and side light scatter, we then saw a large increase in cells with light scatter characteristics of larger cells, and indeed, when we isolated them and stained them, they looked like typical lymphoblasts. We made cDNA from these cells and subtracted with cDNA from myeloid and erythroid cells, and made using this subtractive cDNA library, we then got more cDNA sequences. We were disappointed because we found lots of leucine-rich repeat sequences. A college student came to the laboratory, Jill Setlin, and she, as a way of learning some molecular biology, sequenced the first 22 EST sequences that we had with complete open reading frame, or almost complete open reading frame. And when we looked at her sequences, we were surprised to see that every one of them was different. They differ in the number of these leucine-rich repeat modular units, and the leucine-rich repeat modular units that they were constructed by were all different one from the other. So we finally realized that this is what we should have been looking for and began to concentrate on these very diverse leucine-rich repeat proteins. We call them variable lymphocyte receptors because they were expressed by lymphocytes and highly variable in sequence. This is a stick model of the longest one that we had at that time. And as you can see, it has a signal peptide and that's invariant, and an invariant stalk-like region that is rich in threonines and prolines, and a GPI cleavage site signal, and the most carboxy terminus had hydrophobic residues, was rich in hydrophobic residues, particularly in this location. It had, as most LRR proteins have, and there are many now that have been found, this is a unit or a type of protein that's found essentially in every living thing on our planet, bacteria and plants and invertebrates, all the metazoans seem that have been looked at have had these. They typically have capping N-terminal and C-terminal LRRs. These were fairly lengthy, with this one 58 and this one 31 residues. And the VLRs had invariably an LRR1 of 18 residues and a connecting peptide of 13, and then variable numbers of these LRRs that are 24 residues each. So we expressed this construct in a mouse thymoma cell line, and Gertz Ehrhardt, a postdoctoral fellow in the laboratory, I won't show you the data, showed that it could be cleaved from the surface by phospholipase C of bacterial origin and released into the supernatant. So indeed, these are expressed as by GPI linkage. In looking using LRR protein structures that had been solved, the Swiss model suggested that this is what that longest VLR would look like. It's like typical of these LRR proteins, a solenoid structure, and the concave surface is lined by beta sheets, or predicted to be by this modeling. And they have this on the capping C-terminal, LRR, this alpha helical structure. Now, I mentioned that they were highly variable. This cartwheel diagram tries to give you an image of how variable they are, one from the other. It's not an ancestral tree, but it tells you how different one is from it the other, another that is most resembles it. So from lamprey larvae number 11, 52 cDNA clone, and lamprey larvae number 10, seventh clone, you can see that the sequence is about 12 or 13% coming down and going back up. So these are about 25% different from each other, and so on around this diagram. The red ones come from the cocktail-stimulated larvae, and the green ones are not stimulated. And you can see from the stimulated ones, we found three matching pairs of identical sequence, suggestive or possibly suggesting clonal amplification, particularly because these asterisks here represent results by single-cell PCR. And 12 of 13 wells that we dropped, trying to drop one lymphocyte in, we got only one VLR sequence, suggesting that these are expressed products of only one allele. So this plus that feature suggests that they are showing allelic exclusion of these VLRs, and that you there may be clonal amplification. The real question, of course, is what is the genetic basis for this? And using N-terminal and C-terminal probes, doing southern blots, we could quickly see that there were not a lot of genes for all of these variable VLR sequences. So it's very much unlike plant resistance genes that have LRR blocks in their structure that are sensing pathogen invasion. These seem to be, there seems to be only one or possibly two genes. And when we did pulse field gels using larger segments of DNA, fragments of DNA, there was a single band for V and, for the N-terminal and C-terminal probes. There's not much polymorphism, as you can see here, but some. Here's with BAMH1 digest for larvae number 13. You see multiple bands, whereas not in the others. We then went to Chris Amamiya, who created a large, who created a back library from a single lamprey. And we screened his back clones for ones that would react with both N-terminal and C-terminal probes, and we picked out ones that were polymorphic, with the polymorphism that I just showed you evidence for. And we only found one VLR gene, and it was incomplete. It had coding sequence for the signal peptide in the stalk region, but only parts of the N-terminal 5' LRR and parts of the C-terminal LRR, two incomplete coding regions. It was a fairly large one because there was a large, two large intervening non-coding sequences of about 6 kb each. These lack canonical splice sites and don't have coding sequences, so we assume that those are intervening sequences and not introns, true introns. Flanking this incomplete germline gene, we found lots of cassettes that could encode for the missing parts that would be needed for the mature VLR gene. These were present as singlets or doublets or even a triplet somewhere in here. Most frequently, there were sequences encoding for the LRRNT capping region and the LRR1 together. These were in both orientations, and we found coding regions for the rest of the C-terminal. So we propose that if you could stitch in the these sequences and remove these intervening sequences, you could go from this incomplete germline gene to this mature VLR gene. And we isolated lymphocytes and erythrocytes to test that idea. And using these forward and reverse probes to get PCR products, because mainly these large intervening regions, the germline sequence would be about product would be about 14 kV, whereas the mature ones, with this eliminated, even though they have coding for these other units, are much smaller. And we cloned and sequenced several of these, and all of them were different as well. So lymphocytes somehow stitch in to this incomplete germline gene sequence information that's contained in modular units in the flanking regions. Matt Alder, an MD PhD student in the laboratory, captured intermediates in this process. by using primers that were in this intervening non-coding sequence paired with forward probes shown here, and another one in this intervening sequence paired with a coding region sequence here, and so on. And in that way, captured intermediates in this assembly process. And as you can see, this one is only completes the N-terminal capping LRR. This one has brought in more units and a piece of this one, more units here, more and a piece, more and a piece. Most frequently, and the process starts on both ends of this germline gene, VLR gene, and indicating that they're brought in a piecewise manner, in a stepwise, piecewise manner to generate this kind of final product. Now, how they are joined at the end when they start on the two different ends isn't obvious in this. We propose that this was a gene conversion or gene conversion-like mechanism because the flanking sequences, which we could find to be spliced into some of our mature VLRs, had the homology for short stretches of the donor and the recipient coding units. Now, very recently, Hitoshi Sakano and his colleagues in Japan, Tokyo, have examined one lamprey and generated a huge amount of data to show that indeed this is a gene conversion type of mechanism. And their data, where they could identify donor and acceptor sites that are brought in a stepwise, piecewise manner, beginning on either end, had short nucleotide sequence homologies that could be used to anchor this donor and acceptor gene site. They thought this could be a copy choice kind of mechanism. It's not the kind of gene conversion mechanism that Rose and Jean-Claude Weil and others have studied for the gene conversion for chickens and rabbits, because there you bring in a coding variable and constant region, or VDJ, sequences, and then use pseudogene sequences that are upstream to modify the sequence by gene conversion. So you modify the existence of an existing sequence, whereas here you're bringing in new sequence to add on. In yeast, there has been a mechanism that's been worked on much earlier that uses very short nucleotide stretches for donor and acceptor units. And so it's presumed that this mechanism involves an annealing of the donor and acceptor sites with cleavage, either a nick or a double-stranded break in this DNA, and the DNA polymerase takes off and copies the donor sequence in this particular mechanism. Now, Hitoshi and his colleagues were able to get a PCR product across this entire germline sequence, which we had not been able to do. And in doing so, they could show that this process begins on either this end or this end, never on both. So this begins not only on either end, but only on one end. They also showed by single-cell PCR that it only occurs on one allele and that the other allele is left in germline configuration. Nothing happens on it. So this is a very interesting process and mechanism about which we still need to know a lot about in terms of the proteins that make the DNA cuts, the proteins that are involved in this repair process, and how you complete the process when you add on, add on, add on, and get to the other end while eliminating all of the non-coding sequence. Now, when we identified this VLR system and this VLR gene that was matured by putting in these flanking sequences, stitching them in, we were interested to see if the hagfish used the same mechanism. And we knew that Casahara, Mansunori Casahara in Japan, who has done a lot of phylogenetic studies on the evolution of MHC genes, among other things, had a large cDNA database from hagfish. And so we contacted him and together analyzed his cDNA sequences to identify VLR genes, mature VLR genes in his cDNA database. In fact, there were two types, and we then identified in genomic DNA two genes, VLRA and VLRB, we call them. B, although it's even more incomplete than the Lamprey one, is the one that's more like the Lamprey germline VLR gene. And we found that these had flanking sequences on both 5' and 3' sites, so, and that the diversity was of the same order of magnitude. We worked with a computational biologist here at NIH, at NCI, Igor Rogozin and Lax Eyer, and another colleague of theirs. Lax and Eager analyzed about 600 mature VLR sequences that we provided them with to see if these were assembled in any sort of programmed way or if they were randomly assembled by the use of these flanking sequences units. And their data suggested that they were a random assembly process. And moreover, they calculated that the potential repertoire that could be expressed on Lamprey lymphocytes, presumably, was in the same order of magnitude as our B-cell antibody repertoire is potentially. That is, 10 to the 14th different sequences could be generated in this by this mechanism. Now, Lamprey don't have 10 to the 14th lymphocytes, but neither do we have 10 to the 14th B cells. So this is a potential repertoire and not actual, of course. We postulated that these were used as anticipatory receptors, and somehow they were released from the cells in order to give the agglutinin responses that had been reported earlier. The Lax and Eager also looked for residues that were, or the coding units for residues that were changed by non-synonymous substitution versus those with synonymous substitution. And that ratio, if it's greater than one, is considered evidence for positive selection. For example, the peptide binding sites of MHC genes or MHC proteins show those same kinds of positive selection in a Darwinian fashion. And they found that residues that showed evidence of positive selection were concentrated primarily on the beta sheets on this con-predicted concave surface, suggesting that maybe antigen binding would occur here. Now, very recently, Kim and his colleagues in Korea have solved the structure of hagfish VLRA and VLRB. And as you can see, the structure looks much like the one predicted by Swiss model. And I'll come back to other features that they suggested for these molecules. But the real question that we've been interested in is, can they really use these as anticipatory receptors to elicit an immune response or an adaptive response, as might be suggested by the fact that they are sitting on lymphocytes, each lymphocyte having only one of these VLR sequences and each of which was likely to be different from the others. And so we set out, we needed a way to determine the cells and the VLR products that would be a universal probe. And so we made monoclonal antibodies to the stalk-like region, which I mentioned has invariable, an invariant sequence. And we found that of these cells in that little lymphocyte button from these various tissues that I showed you evidence of earlier, only a portion of them were VLR-bearing cells, more in the kidney than in the blood and in the typhlosol. And one of the reasons that we got some of the genes that we found, many of which were platelet genes platelets use, is that the VLR negatives were mainly thrombocytes. They are nucleated cells involved in blood clotting, whereas the ones that were VLR positive were the lymphocyte cells that we were interested in. Here's Matt has shown using these that these cells are primarily located within blood vessels, and we're looking here in the gill region of a lamprey larvae. And among these blood cells are these cells stained by immunofluorescence here that seem to have a lot of the VLR product that they are making, more than just a thin rim around the membrane. Here's how they look in a histochemical identification of the VLR positive cells. All of them essentially are within these blood vessels. These are smaller capillary units or smaller units going out to these projections on the gills. When Matt immunized these lamprey larvae, we used an exosporium from Bacillus anthracis because colleagues of ours, John Carney and Chuck Turnbow, were looking at the mouse monoclonal antibody response to anthrax and anthrax capsular or coat proteins. And they had found that a coat protein called BCLA is a dominant antigen for mice. These lamprey also respond with increasing levels of soluble VLRs in their plasma that seem to be specific for the Bacillus anthracis and not reactive or not very reactive with Bacillus subtilis, a closely related Bacillus spore-forming organism. And the BCLA antigen, recombinant protein, they also were able to recognize, and with increasing levels of these VLR reactive. Now this is what that coat protein BCLA looks like, and this is data from Chuck Turnbow's laboratory, our colleague. This this is a type 2 membrane bound surface protein, and that you can eliminate by, of course, mutating the gene. The carboxy terminus of this is formed mainly by beta sheets, and if you make recombinant carboxy terminus, it spontaneously forms crystals of trimers of this C-terminal domain. The lamprey makes antibodies, or VLR antibodies, to the to this BCLA C-terminal domain, recombinant protein, and it doesn't react with other controls. In this is immunized versus non-immunized in this, and so you can see that it's fairly specific for the immunizing Bacillus strain. Even more impressive is that we took activated lymphocytes from these immunized larvae, made a cDNA library, and expressed those cDNAs in human embryonic kidney cell line 293. And Brant Heron, a postdoctoral fellow in the laboratory, has identified multiple clones of recombinant VLRs that bind to to the immunizing Bacillus anthracis wild type, and you can see that they don't cross react or don't react with Bacillus anthracis where this gene has been deleted, and don't react with Bacillus cereus or this other related strain. This one is so closely related that its C-terminal domain has only about 10 residues, exposed, solvent-exposed residues, that differ from the Bacillus anthracis. And there's absolutely no cross-reactivity for any of these recombinant BLRs that are made. This kind of specificity is even more striking than mouse monoclonal antibodies that our colleague John Carney makes, because his monoclonals have some cross-reactivity, whereas we could see none with these recombinant BLRs. So they seem to be highly specific. The other interesting thing that I will not show you data for is that the sequence of each one of these is different. So they make a diverse set of soluble VLR antibodies in response to immunization. The larvae had been shown by Gary Lookman earlier, lamprey had been shown to make antibodies or VLR agglutinins to, or agglutinins, not known to be VLRs then, after immunization with human erythrocytes, that the data suggested. So we went back and looked to see if these were VLRs, and they indeed are. We could reproduce his data. After immunizing with human old erythrocytes, we couldn't remove any of those with a control antibody, but we could remove them with the anti-VLR antibody. His data suggested that the lamprey responded to a carbohydrate determinant, the old blood group substance called H antigen. This is a carbohydrate determinant. We obtained from John Lowe Chinese hamster ovary cells that had been transduced with the glycosyl transferase that creates this carbohydrate determinant. And as you can see here, immunized lamprey plasma, see the transduced CHO cells, not shown here. The non-transduced CHO cells would have been like the unimmunized control here. And here's a monoclonal anti-H antibody made by mice, a mouse, for comparison. So they can make VLR antibodies in response to immunization. And so far, I've only shown you particulate antigens, and the old data suggested that they do not respond well to soluble antigens, and we find the same. We found that they can make highly specific antibodies not only to these two antigens that I've shown you, but also to other bacterial antigens, LPS from the bacteria that we inject with them, also influenza viral antigens, both against hemagglutinin and neuraminidase envelope proteins in work done with Richard Compans. So they can make a highly diverse, highly specific response of VLR antibodies. This just shows you after we've injected with the anthrax exosporium, and I should tell you that we're giving a huge dose, more than 100 times the amount of exosporium needed to immunize. And here you can see that you get, compared with the naive animal, and the again, this is forward and side scatter, a large increase in these larger cells. These are the ones that express VLR, and the ones that are left behind are the mainly the thrombocytes that I mentioned earlier. So you start out in a naive animal with the VLR positive lymphocytes being relatively small, and in this case with a huge injection of Exosporium, which obviously works as a global mitogen, you induce lymphocyte enlargement of cells, some of which have size light scatter characteristics of the larger cells. So Matt then looked to see if he could identify the cells that are secreting these VLR antibodies. And where were they in this spectrum of cells that I've just shown you? So here he found that the cells that are not enlarged after this immunization had no VLR secreting cells by an ELISpot assay. Neither did cells even in this area where the larger lymphoid cells were found. Those came out here from these very large cells, and they are VLR positive. So the cells that secrete these VLRs still express them on their surface. And remember, this is a GPI-linked linkage that you see. So what about those secreted VLR antibodies? Brand Heron, the postdoctoral fellow I mentioned earlier, did a Western blot of lamprey serum, and as you can see, there's, and this is a very, very short exposure, there seem to be loads of these proteins present in serum even without immunization. They're very large, and they are variable sizes, as you would expect if they had different numbers of modular units. After he reduced disulfide bonds with 2-ME treatment, you can see that the individual units are between 30-something and 40,000 apparent molecular weight each. So if you look at one of Brandt's clones, there's not this kind of heterogeneity. And incompletely reduced molecules have a dimer size. So we've used this data to predict, this is our working model for how these VLR antibodies might look that are secreted. And so you can see that our model is highly influenced by IgM antibodies, which is where we are, have experience. And we are currently testing this model because we have the recombinant proteins that are being made and secreted by the transduced 293 cells. When Brandt located on a predicted model the residues that were most changed in the in his recombinant VLRs that bound or didn't bind the C-terminal domain of this anthrax antigen, there was a clustering of those that were changed most frequently on this concave surface. Kim et al. Had used the sequences that we had obtained with Casahara to do the same kind of structure modeling with their using their filled-in model of the structure they had solved. This one was just a predicted, so it doesn't it's not as nice as this one, and is just a predicted one. But you can see that they match very, very closely in predicted sites for antigen binding. Now, Kim and his colleague pointed out that the size of this predicted antigen binding site is almost twice the size of the antibody binding site from our antibodies. There's also this predicted site of binding is supported by results so far from an ongoing site-directed mutagenesis study that Brandt is doing with these recombinant VLRs that do or do not bind to antigen. So it would appear that the jawless vertebrates evolved a mechanism for generating a highly diverse repertoire of antigen, of anticipatory antigen receptors that they express in a monoallelic, clonally dispersed fashion that they can use in some way to be activated by and to secrete multimers or oligomer forms of these antibodies, VLR antibodies, that are using different building blocks than our immunoglobulin BDJ-based antibody structures. They seem to be able to make a large number of antibodies. I didn't show you data, but our data suggests that these can have very high avidity, as you might anticipate from having multiple antigen binding units. We haven't yet determined the affinity for the specific individual units. And because these are highly stable structures and highly diverse, highly specific in reactivity, we are testing the idea that they may be used for a variety of utilitarian purposes. And with that, I'd like to point out who did this work. I mentioned many of them in the talk. Zev Panzer, who now has his own laboratory at the Marine Biology Laboratory in Baltimore. He spoke about the work, much of which I've recapitulated at a NIH earlier. Matt, Brandt, and Gertz, I mentioned. Lanier made the monoclonal anti-VLR antibodies. Larry helped with the flow cytometry. Jill did the initial sequencing that gave us the clue as to VLR diversity. I didn't mention the current work of these other people in the lab, our colleagues who helped us with the immunogen, with immunohistology. It started with a collaboration with Jan Klein, then in a Max Planck Institute that he headed in Tübingen. Chris Amamiya and Neil at Seattle. Mansanori Kasahara and his colleagues, Igor Rogozin and Lax Eyer here at NCI, and their colleague at Storrs, Galina Glasgow. Thank you very much.
I want to thank Max and invite questions. There will be a reception in the lobby afterwards, but we have time for a few questions, and then you can meet the speaker at the reception.
Max, have you looked at whether divalent, tetravalent, what valency is the best for inducing? You said the primary protein doesn't work very well, but and particles work best. But has anyone looked whether the antigen being dimeric, two response four, or so forth?
We haven't yet, Lou. We're doing that, and we're in the early stages of that analysis with these different recombinant VLR antibodies. One of them that Brandt has looked at so far that binds so avidly that you have to use very, very harsh methods to get it off of an affinity column. If you cut off the tail that has the cysteines that are used in disulfide bonds to give you single units, the reactivity is lost that we below our detection threshold. Either he's modified the structure in some way, or multiple units are needed, but we'll find out exactly what the situation is as we go forward and analyze more of these clones.
Max?
Yes, Ron.
David is here, and so if I'm being really silly about structural issues, he can correct me, but this looks, at least at low resolution to my eyes, an awful lot like the TLR structures. And the question is, that's just chance? Or do you think that we took a structure that was actually used for detection of pathogens, invaders, and it got elaborated here as one solution to having, if you will, an adaptive response growing out of the innate response?
Well, David can answer that question much better than I, of course. But my understanding, if I can use the microphone just to, and you can correct me, David, is that of the LRR proteins whose structure has been solved, like TLR3 that David and Ian have solved, all of them have this same basic crescent or horseshoe configuration depending on how many of the LRR modular units they have. They all have these capping N-terminal and C-terminal LRRs, and they are solenoid structures as suggested here. So in that sense, they seem to be have some monotony, I would say, about their structure. But in terms of sequence and binding specificity, they can, of course, be very, very different. Maybe I didn't answer your question.
The question is whether you think that this was just a protein motif that happens to be used for these recognition purposes sort of independently, or whether the initial motif was in the TLRs and it has evolved to this, quote, adaptive recognition structure. So this actually was built on that base evolutionarily.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't get the subtlety of your question. And I can't answer that. It could be that that was the case, because TLRs were evolved, as far as we know, well before BLRs. But as you also know, they are coded by fixed genetic units and not shuffled and modified in their structural coding sequences. So what the driving force was to generate this and what the survival value was, we all have our ideas, but it's essentially hand-waving when we try to speculate about exactly how it occurred. But these building blocks, of course, have been used, as I alluded to, throughout life on our planet. And they've been used for a lot of functions, usually in protein-protein interactions, and many times for defense purposes, as in TLRs and plant resistance genes, but for many different kinds of functions. So it's a It's certainly a very generically adaptable building block. Figuring out how to generate diversity was the trick, it would appear, from these for these jawless vertebrates.
One more question from Polly, and then we'll meet at the reception.
So last night I was having dinner with Heinz Arnheider. We were discussing this. He asked me a question, and he's not going to get up and ask it, so I'm going to ask you. What it was odd is that before the jawless vertebrates, there doesn't seem to be any adaptive immune system that we looks anything like this, either one, ours or theirs. And so his thought was, if I can get it right, if there's an ancestor to these two branches, the jawed and the jawless, that had an adaptive immune system, and we either lost the one they have or they lost the one we have, you might find some remnant of that in the DNA. So do you find any remnant of the jawless system in our DNA? And do you find any remnant of our system in their DNA?
Well, we didn't find any of the cardinal elements, as I mentioned, of our adaptive immune system. T cell receptor, B cell receptor like, MHC class 1, 2, and so forth. RAG1, RAG2 elements, or their ancestral genes, can be found even back in invertebrates. But as far as the VLRs, they could have been, if this paraphyletic origin model, which is sort of like that more colorful model that I showed you based on the fossil remains, suggesting that lamprey are a sister group with jawed vertebrates and that hagfish are not a sister group with the lamprey, having come earlier. If that were the case, then this mechanism for generating diversity with these LRR building blocks in the way that I mentioned would have had to have been invented by a common ancestor to be in both hagfish and lamprey. If this were correct, one would expect to see remnants of the VLRs in jawed vertebrates, because nature doesn't like to throw away things that it has invented. But it would have the disadvantage, potentially, of some point in perhaps one of those jawed vertebrates, the astracoderms with the dermal armor, which is thought to be on the way to our jawed vertebrates, if they had had both VLRs and BCR, TCR systems, you would expect, and they were randomly assembled and expressed in a clonally dispersed fashion on lymphocytes, it would potentially be an autoimmune hazard, or maybe the danger, I can't explain it in your terms, but there's another idea that's been derived from sequencing a lot of common genes in hagfish and lamprey and finding very few differences in those sequences that suggests that hagfish and lamprey are a sister group. And in this instance, the common ancestor could have been an ancestor of the two of these, and it wouldn't have been seen in our lineage and even remnants of that. So far, no one has found a good footprint of VLRs in jawed vertebrates that I'm aware of. So one could even take this and speculate that maybe the reason that hagfish and lamprey survived and all of the other jawless vertebrates didn't is because they had the advantage of this recombinant, this gene conversion mechanism of generating a diverse set of antigen anticipatory receptors. Mind you, we've not shown their protective value yet. We're working on that. That's a harder question. Why do invertebrates need an adaptive immune system? Why don't they need it if we do? We know pretty surely that we can't do without our recombinatorial adaptive immune system. If you look at kids who don't have T or B cells or can't generate T and B cell receptors and hence lack them, they don't survive more than a few months without repair. They are just living culture tubes almost, even with all of the innate immune mechanisms that we've evolved. However, that... I'm going on too long here. I'll go just 1 second. Remember that since the innate immune system came first and the adaptive immune system layered on top of it, as you know, one is used to trigger the other. And so what existed to start with as a particular fitness advantage may not hold today for a long time after the initial evolution. But the other answer, best answer to that question, is that other metazoan species have achieved extremely complex innate immune systems, some of which can mimic, even for insects, an adaptive response to particular strains of bacterial challenge for which memory can be shown. And one of those systems is the Down syndrome cell adhesion molecule gene DISCAM that you know about as well, that can generate as many as 30-something thousand different receptors expressed on hemocytes as well as other types of cells that can participate in response to a microbe, a potential pathogen. So there may be other ways to do the job, And I think we'll be in for more and more surprises as we learn what other multicellular organisms on our planet use for self-defense.
So thank you. Thank you very much, Max. And it's been a very exciting and stimulating talk, and you're welcome to meet the speaker and continue your conversations.